Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, live coming to you on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And today we have a very special guest, the James Beard Rising Star Chef of the Year, pastry chef Christina Tosi. And Christina is legendary in the pastry world because her work is so eclectic and different and inspiring and, can I say, funky? I mean, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but it is so, I just can't wait to jump into this interview. But let me tell you a little bit about Christina, because Christina is the chef at the Milk Bar and here in New York. But before that, she really worked for all the great guys. You know, she worked at Wiley Dufresne's, WD-50. She worked before that for Boulay, who's so classic. And she was an editorial assistant at Sever. And she even worked front of the house at Aqua Grill in the city. She is now with the David Chang Empire, I guess we can call it that. And from 2008, she's the founder and the chef and the owner of Mama Fuco Milk Bar. And she's got 6 locations in the East Village, Midtown, Upper West Side, Williamsburg, Carroll Gardens. And I think right now, since it's August, Montauk would
That's
be my
right.
favorite one. I hope you get to go out there a lot. But let me, if you didn't, you know, follow the Beard Awards this year and find out that she was the Rising Star Chef, you might know her because Bon Appetit in September 2010 named her one of the most exciting, well, not her, but, you know, Milk Bar, as one of the most exciting bakeries in the country. And it is. I will tell you, it is. And when she was pastry chef at Momofuku Co., you know, the one that you can't get into, you know, which has 2 Michelin stars, you know, she supplied, well, she was the chef for Mama Fuco Co., but she now still supplies Mama Fuco Sam and the noodle bar. And she helped Mama Fuco Sam, reach number 31 on Restaurant Magazine's top 100 restaurants in the world. And last but not least, you know, we will tip our hats to the New York Times, and she made the New York Times Tea Magazine Nifty 50 list. I mean, This woman's extraordinary, and her background is so much fun. So, welcome, Christina.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's really exciting. So, I don't know where to start because I can't. You know, we're going to wind up somewhere really getting into the pretzel milk that you make.
Salty and sweet.
Salty and sweet. So, tell me, where did you grow up? You know, did you come from a gastronomic home, or did you come from a funky home? You know, tell me a little bit about your upbringing.
For me, I always think that I had a really boring childhood, believe it or not. My family is from Ohio, and I was born in Ohio, but I was raised in Virginia, in Northern Virginia. My family moved to the Washington, D.C. area for work. My father was an agricultural economist in the dairy division, funnily enough.
Oh, my gosh. And Milk Bar.
And my mother, an accountant. And I grew up in Virginia, in Northern Virginia. There's nothing special about it, sort of just cookie cutter homes. My upbringing was very far from gastronomical. It was, I had 2 working parents and an older sister. But I think we were very much raised with the sort of deep-rooted matriarchs that cook and bake in the kitchen. lifestyle. So a lot of what we had growing up was TV dinners or mac and cheese or grilled cheese and tomato soup. But baking was always a really big foundation in my upbringing. That's what you did for fun. That's what you did for others in a very sort of nurturing, spirited fashion.
What kind of stuff?
Brownies, apple cobbler, oatmeal raisin cookies, all of the sort of like standard, what I think of as standard Americana baked goods that mm-hmm. are baked for any occasion, mm-hmm. not just for special occasions. And I will say that my mother and my father both have very sweet teeth, and I definitely I definitely picked up on that trait at a very early age. I was actually a very picky eater, so not even the grilled cheese sandwiches with tomato soup. That was a hard dinner to make me eat, because I was really just looking for the brownie or the oatmeal raisin cookie at the end of the rainbow.
Well, so was that your carrot? If you ate your meal, you got the dessert?
Yes. I remember even being in elementary school and in grade school and refusing. I'm a very stubborn person, believe it or not, and refusing to eat the sort of savory part of my school lunch. And my only barter was that I would eat the dessert. If they just let me get up from the savory part of my school lunch.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really bad. It was really bad habits that I really, I didn't know at that time that I was really sort of planning for what my future would become. But I was raised to sort of go to school and be a straight A student and follow the sort of path of my parents. So
I have a feeling you were a straight A student.
I was.
Because you went to the UV, University of Virginia.
I was a pretty big overachiever, and I really loved the challenge mm-hmm. of sort of all day studying, all night studying. And my release would be baking in the kitchen. I would make Rice Krispie treats with any cereal except for Rice Krispies. I would make these concoctions of cookie dough or brownies, and I would make, you know, the standard brownie recipe of my family, and then figure out what funny things I could put in it from the cupboards.
What was the funniest thing you put in it?
I don't know. I feel like you'd have to ask my mom or my sister. I would... anything in the cupboard. I mean, I had no limits. There were plenty of failures as there were as many failures as there were successes, but that was sort of my late night meanderings after a hard day of studying and homework.
So when you went to the University of Virginia, and I'll point out you studied electrical engineering, yeah. Where did that come from?
I really loved mathematics. I got that mathematic passion from my mother, and I loved a portion of science, a portion of sort of applied science. And I think that much more speaks to my love for baking than maybe the real life application of it. I ended up majoring in math, in applied mathematics and the Italian language, because I just loved both of those things. They were both things that sort of spoke to my right brain and my left brain. And I knew that I had to go to college, but I kind of knew that I wasn't going to make it my full-time job. So my real focus was to find the subject matters that I was really passionate about and to do a really great job and to get out so that I could move to New York City to be a pastry chef.
Oh, really? So you knew back then you wanted to be a pastry chef.
I was doing the study real hard by day, study real hard at night, and I would bake three or four things every night in
really?
The middle of the night in college. Because I just loved doing it. I loved.
You must have had a lot of friends.
I had a lot of friends. I loved the studious nature of school, but at the end of the day, it was like I couldn't go to sleep until I baked two or three things. I'd make these triple layer cheesecakes. I'd make these crazy sandwich cookies layered with anything, you know, from crazy frostings to ice creams. And I would just hand them out in that same sort of nurturing spirit that I was raised with. So it was this really funny culmination of my upbringing, but I kind of knew as I got a lot closer to graduation that I didn't want a desk job. I wanted to be a crazy person and stand on my feet and bake all day and all night.
Okay, but during college, you did go to Florence to study, didn't you?
I did.
How long were you in Florence? And
were
you baking when you were there?
I was eating while I was in Florence. I wasn't baking, but I was there for almost a year studying. It was part of my sort of discovery of what I wanted to do with my life and what I loved, but what I really wanted to, which love of mine I really wanted to make my full-time job.
So what kind of desserts did you discover there?
I ate gelato three times a day, four times a day.
Now, I have to point out, because you can't see her, she is so tiny. I mean, I can't believe it. Yeah. I'm so jealous.
I always say that when people comment on my physique, I always say, I don't really know. I think I'm like a real life hummingbird or something, but sugar translates into energy for me, and it always has.
Okay, so you like the gelato.
The gelato. I love their biscotti. I loved a lot of their sort of hearty wood burning oven baked bread, the sort of complexity of textures and flavors I really fell in love with. And that's something that, at least where I grew up, was really hard to get your hands on. The flavors of Florence in Italy are just so rich. A hazelnut doesn't taste like a hazelnut in Italy does not taste like a hazelnut in the States. Now it does, because you can get your hands on better product and better produce. But back then it was like tasting every flavor for the first time. I was also an infamously picky eater growing up. So I was really sort of starting to come into my own and broadening my horizons in terms of food and flavors and depths of flavor and balance and texture. My father is Italian by heritage, so I sort of have a little bit of it in my blood, but it was really an eye-opening experience from a culinary standpoint. Even though my intention was to go and really hone in on the language, it ended up being a real culinary journey for me.
Well, that I'm so jealous of that too. So, you know, so here you are, and you graduate college. So you undergraduate.
That's right.
And then the first thing you did was go to New York?
In between graduating from college, I had a friend that worked on this island off the coast of New Hampshire called Star Island. It's this huge conference center that hosts anywhere from 500 to 700 guests in a week. You take a boat out from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Believe it or not, there's a coast to New Hampshire. It's 12 miles long. And she was a college friend. She knew how much I loved to bake by virtue of all of the benefits that that she had from the brownies and the cheesecake. And she got me a gig running this bakery on Star Island. Sight unseen, they hired me to run this bakery.
To run the bakery, and you've never been in the business before.
God knows what she told them about me. But she had them convinced, based on what she had seen from my baking, my late night baking in college, she got me this job. And I moved to this island in New Hampshire, and that was sort of going to be I'm going to make sure that this is really what I want to do all day and all night before I move to the city. I had already applied to the FCI. I already kind of knew that I was that was my next sort of path, but I had a few months in the summer to kill. And so I thought, I'm going to give myself a real life experience.
Oh my God. Because, you know, baking for yourself is one thing, but running a bakery is production, and that's a whole different. You don't just take one brownie recipe and do it 100, you know, ramp it 100.
No, it was feeding this conference center island of 500 to 700 people three square meals.
Oh,
so breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I got I got schooled on hard knocks of bread baking, you know.
Oh, you had to do the bread
scale,
as well.
Everything.
Did you have?
One. I mean, I would wake up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You're on this beautiful island, so you're in this beautiful atmosphere. I'd go down to someone gave me this little bakery. There was a huge 140 quart mixer. I had no clue how to work it, but the first two days were the hardest days. My bread dough didn't rise. You know, I made all of the rookie mistakes. And I remember the first meal, the breakfast, lunch, and dinner of my first day, I went down in a ball of flames. And the second day was like a rebirth. And I just, every day I learned, every day I challenged, I read, and it was amazing. It was amazing. It was one of the biggest challenges of my life, which is sort of funny to say.
Were they sad to see you go? Because by the end, you had really worked out how to do production.
You know, it was a seasonal gig, but I think a lot of the guests Yeah, I definitely had my own
plastered all over now. Christina Tosi was the baking chef here.
I was raised to be very humble and to keep your head down and to work hard. So I a lot of times have a hard time sort of seeing outside of that. But I definitely baked with all of my heart, and I baked with that the same sort of style that I think I hold on to today. And I got right off that island and I moved to New York City.
Okay.
Because that's where I knew I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the sort of city that never slept, and I wanted to be in a kitchen. But first I knew I really needed the fundamentals of an education, which is why I applied to the FCI and went to the FCI.
Okay, the French Culinary Institute. And once again, a disclaimer, folks.
Yes.
This isn't an ad. I just happen to know lots of our graduates, and they're in great places. And
yeah.
I'm so happy we were able to really set the foundation for you.
For me, it was the thing that pulled me to New York. I knew that I wanted to go to a school that was... I made my choice, you know, I really did my research and I made my choice, and it was very important for me to go to a school that was in the city and was downtown and was in the middle of it all, because I knew I could go to school by day and just get into a kitchen by night. Did you
intern while you were in school?
I did.
I interned
at Boulay, and then it ended up becoming a full-time job, and I don't think I slept. I think I slept 2 hours a night, but I was so excited to learn by day, and I would just get right out of school and I'd run downtown, you know, down to Tribeca to Boulay, and work for hours in the kitchen at night, and then I'd get home and I'd study for the next day of class, and it was like I had been waiting all
my
life.
It's an intense program. It's only 6 months.
It is.
And so you're just like learning things, and you really have to study.
You have to study, and that really sort of going into the kitchen at night was the greatest way to sort of lock in the stuff that I had learned from the day, which is what I really loved about it.
Yeah. So, okay. So 6 months later, you're out.
I'm out.
Yeah. And so David hired you right away.
I worked at Boulay right after school as a full-time employee. And I was there for a little over a year. And you typically stay in a kitchen for a year at the minimum to really get what you can get out of it and really be a part of the team. And that commitment is a really important commitment in kitchens in New York. And I got out of the kitchen of Boulay, and I really wanted to figure out, it was a very classic kitchen, like you said, and I really wanted to figure out, I was just excited to be a part of the food world, and I really wanted to figure out what other avenues, you know, I was still new. I knew I hadn't, I'm
no,
young.
You had to do your journeyman and journey. So we're going to take a break here,
okay.
And we're going to come back and see how your New York journey started.
Has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Seeing a need to help people sort through all the misinformation about healthy eating, Whole Foods Market added a seventh core value: to promote the health of our stakeholders through healthy eating education. In our stores, we give you the tools you need for choosing the most nutritious foods and healthy recipes, as well as offering classes with nutritionists and cooking coaches to help inspire good health and well-being. Stop by your local store today and learn more about our Health Starts Here program and wellness clubs, or online at wholefoodsmarket.com/healthstartshere.
Well, welcome back. This is Chef's Story with Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm talking with the great pastry chef, Christina Tosi. Who you probably know, who's the founder, chef, and owner of Mama Fuco Milk Bar, and works for all the other Mama Fucos supplying their pastries. And we're just into her story about after she gets out of all her schools, she's starting the journey of being a pastry chef in New York. She just got out of Boulay. How long did you work at Boulay?
I interned there for the 6 months that I was at the FCI, and then I worked there for a year and a half as a pastry cook.
Year and a half. That's so a, you really earned your stripes, because David is
I tell you, it is a tricky kitchen, but I knew I was going to go hard. I knew I was going to get into New York City and go hard.
Was Bill Yosius the pastry chef there when
he
you
was
there?
Not. Alex Gruner.
Oh, Alex
was,
Gruner.
And
right.
He's now the pastry chef at Blue Hill Stone Barns.
Ah, and Bill kitchen. Went to the White House.
He did.
Yeah. So, okay. So then where did you go after Boulay?
I got out of Boulay and I decided I really wanted to be as well-rounded as I could. I knew I was still young and had the opportunity to get my hands dirty in as many different fields in the food world as possible. So I was an editorial assistant at Savour.
Oh, with Coleman? Was Coleman
yeah,
there then?
He was.
Coleman Andrews?
Coleman Andrews. He's great. I was a food runner at Per Se because I really wanted to understand the front of house portion of the restaurant. I don't know, maybe that was my calling. I knew I was just excited to be a part of food. I helped Friends food style and cater. I was just so excited to be a part of it, and I wanted to learn as much as I could about about as broad of a scope of the industry as possible. But after doing that for about 2 years, I really missed being in a kitchen. Mm-hmm. So I volunteered to work at WD-50. I was always really drawn to the sort of left field nature of cooking, at least in comparison to Boulay.
What do you call left
of
field?
WD-50. You know, it's there are clearly rules to it, but there are no rules. There are no rules in comparison to sort of the classic French cooking when you look at the menu at WD-50. The plating is totally original. The approach to food is gettable and it translates, but it's still completely original. It's sort of like Wiley was making his own rules in terms of how a dish was composed, how it was served, the environment in which it's served, and that I was really drawn to that, obviously, for all right. for so many reasons. And I didn't know what I thought. I'm not that creative of a person. You know, I was raised to be this sort of straight A student, and I don't think my creativity comes anywhere close to probably being that much of an asset to him. So I thought, I'm just going to walk in the door and offer to work for free until someone thinks I'm good enough, or until I'm good, worthy enough to be a cook there.
So did you go in for savory or sweet?
I went in for sweet. Sam Mason was the pastry chef.
Great.
And you know, that was
Now we should say WD-50 is Wiley Dufresne, mm-hmm. 1-star Michelin. Mm-hmm. I'll also say an FCI grad.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. And Sam Mason was the pastry chef at that time. And he was really cutting edge. Yeah?
He really, you know, Claudia Fleming and Karen Damasco were the really big pastry chefs in the city, and they were doing something that I think is one part of what I tap into as a pastry chef, and I got a lot of influence from them and their dishes, though I never worked for them. But for me, I really wanted to work for Sam. He was the pastry chef there doing, you know, crazy things like red bell pepper cake with passion fruit puree and cornbread ice cream, and he was doing all of these and the French toast with brown butter ice cream and maple gel, and he was doing all of these things, and it was right before the internet and blogging and all of the resources that we have today to stay on top of what people are doing and who they are, and it was all just word of mouth. It was sort of the last moments of the word of mouth.
Secret society,
the secret
handshakes
in the city and in the kitchens in the city, and all people wanted to do was work for him. And I thought, I'm just going to walk in there and just offer to work for free until I don't, if I
Did
have
you?
To peel potatoes. Yeah, yeah. I blanched tomatoes for like my first 5 days there.
Really?
I blanched tomatoes and scaled out bread dough, you know, and all I wanted to do was just be around it.
And you had worked at Boulay for a year and a mm-hmm. half and did all this other stuff in Savour, and you were willing to go in and blanch tomatoes. I think that says a lot. The dedication, that to me is very impressive. So go on, come on. I don't want to.
So I went in and I did that for about 6 months, and then, it's a very small team, so there's not a lot of turnover, there's not a lot of movement. You really have to get your foot in the door. And one of the pastry cooks was leaving, and they offered me a job. And I remember I remember my first day as a real cook and just being, I was just like, I'm gonna be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen. And I did my best to be, and I tried to sort of implement new systems and There's family meal that's served every day, but nobody ever serves dessert during family meal. So I was like, I'm going to serve dessert every single day for family meal, sometimes twice a day. And I would use that sort of time. I'd go into work early to make these crazy creations. I remember...
That's because that's the only thing you eat. Yeah. So you wouldn't eat family meal if
that
wasn't
true. And so I'd make crazy pies and cookies, or I'd, you know, teach myself how to make soft pretzels or English muffins or what have you. And I'd use the staff as my sort of like taste test. And Wiley has such a great point of view about classic stuff as well as the sort of left field approaches to food. And
okay,
and
so how did you, how long were you at WD-50?
I was there for about a year and a half as well.
Okay, and then what happened?
I taught myself in the meantime how to write these hazard analysis plans called HACCP plans. They are to sort of trace the use of a certain technique called cryovacking, which is a machine that's more or less like a food saver. It sucks all the air out of a plastic bag, creating an anaerobic environment. And in New York City, the health department requires these hazard analysis plans to be written if you're going to use this machine or this technique in a restaurant. And I had taught myself how to do it for Wiley when I was a pastry cook, because I'm overachieving and I liked a good challenge. Mm. And Dave Chang, who is a great friend of Wiley Dufresne, needed a similar plan done and needed help in the same sort of arena. And so as I was leaving WD-50, Wiley said, oh, my friend Dave needs some help. And I was, oh, I'll go help him. You know, that's easy. I like
this
doing this on the side.
The Mama Fuco explosion, right?
That's correct. Okay. Noodle Bar.
He was only Dave Chang back then.
Yeah, he was still, you know, working the line and mopping the floors and just trying to make it work. And so I went up to the East Village from the Lower East Side and met Dave and just got started on this HACCP plan. And I think after our first meeting or our second meeting, I had already left WD-50 and given my notice. Dave was sort of just like, hey, how about, like, I'll just hire you. And I'm like, no, I'll write the plan. Like, you don't have to hire me. And he said, no, I'm going to hire you. And I thought, for what? Like, what job am I going to have at Momofuku? And I don't know, you know, just to, like, be part of the team. We'll figure it out. I have all this stuff to do. No mention of dessert. At that point, I just wasn't even sure what my next sort of path was going to be. I never thought of myself as fancy enough to be this sort of like classic restaurant pastry chef. And so I started working for Dave, doing everything from writing these HACCP plans to, you know, snaking toilets to working the cash register at Sambar.
Really?
And I was just excited to be a part of a team that was so passionate.
So you loved being in the kitchen, and, you know, WD-50 has a very exciting kitchen. And what was it about Dave and Mama Fuco that made you leave kitchen work and snake a toilet?
I had left WD-50 because I loved being a pastry cook, but I thought, I don't think that my path is to become the pastry chef at this restaurant. I'm a detail-oriented person, but I like these weird systematic business details more than the sort of delicate nature of a tuil. And so I had to figure out how to sort of stay true to myself and find the balance. So I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to sort of jump again and settle down and know that it'll sort of all be clear, become clear to me at some point.
You know, for our listeners out there, the HACCP plan is sort of the sanitation plan or whatever for the Department of Health. And most chefs regard it as a root canal. So yeah. Someone like Christina picking it up for these guys shows that she's got right side, left side, and every kind of brain possible to do this. So now you're over there. And mm-hmm. So when does he allow you to jump in the kitchen?
Well, you know, the second I got out of the kitchen from WD-50 and started doing these more sort of day job tasks, I went back to my old ways of working really hard by day and going home and baking at night. So I would come to work every morning at Momofuku and I would have a platter full of whatever crazy things I baked the night before. And mm-hmm. I think Dave caught on pretty quickly that I was going home every night and baking these things because it's what I really love to do. And one day he would joke about it when I would feed him whatever I brought in, like, you should just put a dessert on the menu at Noodle Bar, at Sambar. And I'd be like, yeah, no, because I didn't have the confidence than either to know that I was really going to be a pastry chef in this capacity. And one day he sort of has a little bit of a temper, or his patience sometimes falls short. And I think one day he was just sick of talking about it. And he, you know, I'd brought something in, he ate it. He sort of slammed it down. I think they were like these weird miso white chocolate brownies or something. And he sort of put it back down on the plate. And he was just like, this is delicious. Like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. Go into the kitchen and make something for dinner. And this was at Sambar. So just go, we're in the basement of this office. There's a little prep kitchen next door. He was like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't care what you make. Just make sure it's good. Make sure it's tasty and it's going on the menu tonight. And like, that's it. I don't want to talk about it. And you know,
Was there a pastry chef in there already?
No, there were no desserts on any of the Momofuku menus. You know, it's a very, Momofuku is infamously sort of male-driven environment. Not in a bad way, just they didn't see any value in desserts. You know, mm-hmm. The original Momofukus were very fast-paced, mm-hmm. get in, delicious food, loud music, loud flavors, get out. Mm. No dessert, no value in dessert. And why in God's name would you want a girl in the kitchen making?
So were you the only girl in the kitchen?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting dynamic too. You know what? We're going to take a break.
Okay.
Because we're going to get into your desserts now, because they are so different. I mean, miso brownies. Okay. We're coming. White chocolate. We're coming back here. We're taking a break.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is dedicated to providing the most up-to-date information and news on the food industry. Interviews with chefs and in-depth pieces on food systems take listeners literally from the farm to the fork. Can you hear this anywhere else? Nope. Press the donate button on our website and learn how you can become a founding member and support the station.
Well, welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we're on Chef Story talking to Christina Tofi, the 2012 Rising Star Chef in New York, and from the James Beard Foundation. And we're just getting into her start at Momofuku and the kinds of wild desserts that she makes. Now, your desserts are incredibly eclectic. I think that nobody else even comes close. And that's probably one of the things that really appealed to David Chang. So, you know, I think it was Bon Appetit magazine, or mm-hmm. said, some pastry chefs sort out fleur de sel and the best, you know, cherry or something like that. And you kind of go to a bodega and get a bag of pretzels and get inspired. So tell us about how you've come up with some of your signature dishes, like crack pie that I'm getting ready to eat right now. She brought me all of this stuff.
If you hear any lip smacking, don't be concerned. You know, I think I was raised to be very resourceful. I was raised by this sort of Midwest mentality of making do with what you have, and baking was a big part of it. So I really always loved the challenge of sort of staying true to that mentality. I think I'm resourceful by nature. And for me, though I love a good hunt for a floor to sell, it's about sort of using what's in your cupboard and trying to find a new and creative way to give it new life. The crack pie that we have on the menu is sort of a pie that you make when you don't have any when you don't have any of those amazing, you know, amazing cherries from the West Coast or from upstate, and, you know, strawberries aren't in season, nothing's in season, but you have some oats in your cupboard for a toasted oat crust, and you have eggs and sugar and heavy cream and all the sort of staples of what you might find in your refrigerator. And I think it's about, I'm a very sort of casual person. I think that a sense of humor is very important. So a lot of stylistically, what we do is finding a way to tap into that nurturing mentality of baking, the resourceful nature of making do with what you have, and finding creative ways to give average ingredients new life.
Okay.
And then
you're
having
talking
fun.
More than average. I mean, a pretzel. Can tell me how pretzel
having
milk.
Fun.
Yeah, having fun. So tell us about that. How does that come about?
For me, pretzel milk was originally... was originally a pretzel ice cream, which I guess is probably left field enough, but we loved drinking the ice, tasting the ice cream base so much, we decided to thin it out a little bit and make it into a drinking milk. But I think the flavor of pretzel is it's salty and malty, and it's sort of what you eat when you are on a picnic or when you're sitting on your couch watching the Olympics. And for us, I think it's about tapping into that part of people's palates and their memories and the relationships that people have with food. And I don't think that it necessarily has to be in a fancy way. I think it's important to be creative but gettable, because what I love most about food is attaching to something and really getting it and feeling like you get it and that you have that relationship with the maker or the creator of whatever that is. I remember at Co, it's a tasting menu only restaurant. I had to come up with these desserts, and I thought, these guys are going to bury these diners with 12 courses of food, and by the time they get to dessert, they're not going to remember what hit them because they're going to be so full. So I also sort of look at it as a little bit of a competition of, these flavors have to be spot on, they have to be memorable, they have to be gettable, and you have to want to come back for more.
So what did you put on the menu at Co?
We had a fried apple pie, a deep fried apple pie, a little homage to the McDonald's apple pie with a miso butterscotch sort of fudgy schmear.
Ooh.
So that sort of salty, sweet umami, and some sour cream ice cream. So it's, you know, like a warm slice of apple pie out of the oven and a tart sour cream and then this miso umami schmear. And
so how do you come up with that? Where's the creative process? And how
I
does
think
it work for you?
It's knowing that your end goal has to be tasty and memorable. So a lot of times, in order to sort of tap into a memory, you have to have a starting place, whether it's something as simple as a pretzel or a potato chip, or it's something like, it's a plated dessert, so let's go with something that's a little bit more composed. Apple pie. Well, we can't serve a slice of apple pie at Co. It needs to be something more refined. Okay, where else does apple pie live? McDonald's little apple pies, and sort of tracing it back like that, and then figuring out where we want to put our flavors and our spins and our personality. Miso, for me, I mean, I was never exposed to it until I started working for Dave. It's a fermented soybean paste, and it has this great salty depth of flavor, and I can eat it with a spoon, which is probably gross to some people, but finding a way to tap into my love for that flavor profile and make it sweet and make it mine and make it my palate, sort of almost Americanize this flavor in a way that you don't have to be raised with miso to understand and get the flavor profile and balance of it.
Mm. So now
it's meshing my sort of, I think my, the history that we've been talking about of all of these things, from sort of being raised down home with this Midwest personality, being formally trained, and then taking, you work in restaurants as a cook or as a pastry cook to take and to learn. And if you don't apply the knowledge and the ingredients and the techniques that you learn, then what's the point of it? You know, that's I think of it at each plated dessert or each cookie or each jug of pretzel milk is a culmination of all of those things.
Absolutely. And I think you have to fit into the culture of your restaurant. And
for
David,
sure.
Chang has a huge personality, and it's huge.
It's loud in every way.
But it's signature, it's
sure.
different, you know, and you have to come into that and get on that train and, you know, be in the same zone.
Yeah.
But, and to compete with his food.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge, did you realize that when you took that job?
I don't think I realized that the job was going to be in the limelight as much as it has become, but I knew that I was going to have to create something to compete. And I think for me, the hardest thing was, how do you make desserts for restaurants that don't have desserts? There are no desserts on the menu, so there's not even a starting point. And trying to figure out how people see the menus at Momofuku. Do they think that they're strictly Asian? Do they understand that they're a culmination of cultures and flavors and techniques? And I just got to get started, and I just have to at least hone in on those principles of flavor and point of view and personality, and just figure out what that is for me, because I'm not going to be able to be anything more than what I am and who I am. And I think a lot of chefs struggle with that. And the answer to it is really just you sit with yourself every day. If you try and be something you're not, or try and create food that doesn't speak to you, if you're trying to speak to somebody else through your food without speaking to yourself, then you're not really going to get very far. And that was what I honed in on, and that's what I really try and continue to hone in on and teach today.
Because you are a personality, you are a signature style, that's why you won Rising Star Chef. No, people could say, oh, did she make, it isn't the Pillsbury Bake Off, you know, when you win something like that. It isn't who makes the best pastry crust. It's assumed you make a fantastic pastry crust, but it's more about what do you bring to the profession, how is it growing, and you are the star chef. Tell me, then you've moved now to Momofuku Milk Bar,
yeah,
where you're a co-owner, and it's 6 locations. This
mm-hmm.
is more a business. Are you in the kitchen?
It is.
Are you creative? Are you managing a team? What's it like today for you? What are you doing today?
You know, I'm all of those things. Every day is a little different. I definitely, over the past 6 months, am in the kitchen a lot less, at least during working hours, which is always sad for me. But I find that the reason that I am who I am and that I had the depth to become what I became was because the pastry chefs that I worked under spent more time teaching me and driving me than they necessarily spent making their own mise en place for the line. Mm-hmm. And so I spend a lot more time doing that. For me, the environment of Milk Bar is just as important as the food we serve. And if you don't teach people to have a point of view and a personality and the trial and error of things, then we have nothing. So I spend a lot of time in the kitchen at my house working on menu stuff and late at night, but I spend a lot of time running the business. And then from a food standpoint, I spend a lot of time with our cooks and our kitchen managers and our sous chefs thinking about new things and the trial and error of things and having tasting parties and talking about the nuances of what a half a gram of salt means, plus or minus, or a little bit more brown sugar, and really honing in on that and trying to create the culture and the community that is what started off as Milk Bar and is what today still is Milk Bar.
What are your favorite desserts at Milk Bar right now?
Right now, we have a green apple cheddar soft serve on the menu.
Ooh,
at the
soft
East
serve
Village
ice cream?
Milk Bar.
Oh my.
We have a blueberry pancake soft serve that's on the menu in Williamsburg.
My daughter would die for that.
That is very quickly becoming my guilty pleasure. We have a raspberry rye soft serve. I'm really into the soft serve flavors that we
raspberry
just put on.
Raspberry rye whiskey?
Raspberry rye. No whiskey.
That would have been mine.
Barely new.
Okay, rye.
Raspberry
like rye bread.
Exactly. And we have a bunch of croissants on the menu now. We take the sort of classic French technique that we learn in culinary school, and we make compound butters to layer into bread dough. So we have a pastrami and rye croissant that is a caraway seed butter stuffed Ooh. With all the fillings of a Reuben. We have a Cubano croissant that is a pickle butter that's layered into bread dough and then stuffed with, you know, marinated pork and mustard and ham. I would say those are my hot, that's what I'm sort of like, those
I'm
are my g- hot
I'm going to say, when did you cook up this stuff? But we know it's in the middle of the
yeah,
night.
Exactly.
You're literally cooking up this stuff.
I think it's important to always still have that sort of relationship at home in my kitchen with with what I was before I was sort of any of these things, because that's where I got my start, and I think that's where I really feel the most grounded today.
So with all these different locations of Milk Bar, do you do mail order? Because a lot of listeners out there might be saying, I want the crack pie, I want to taste it, or the compost cookie, or this corn cookie.
The corn cookie's a sleeper.
How did you make this corn cookie? I've never tasted a cookie like it.
That's a great sort of like tracing your restaurant experience. I love, we used to get freeze-dried fruits and vegetables at WD-50, and we grind them into powders and make different sort of crumbles and crusts and stuff with them. And I fell in love with this freeze-dried corn, and I thought, I'm going to grind this freeze-dried corn into a powder, and I'm going to use it as the flour in a cookie. And it tastes like a cornfield. It tastes like a buttery cornfield.
It does not, I'm eating it right now. It does not taste like cornbread. You know, all cornbreads, you know, are various, and then sometimes you get the moist and the kernel in it. This does taste like you're rolling in a cornfield. It really does. It's amazing. So how do people buy this stuff online? Because it's simple to sit here and talk and
not share. And we have a website. It's milkbarstore.com, and we do mail order throughout the United States as well as internationally.
Oh, cookies. Good. We have 200 countries that listen into this program. So.
Cookies. Pies, cake truffles, which are little bites of our layer cakes, cookbooks, the Momofuku cookbook and the Milk Bar cookbook, with which I still live and die by. I'm a dork. I'll still open my cookbook at home to bake something. Tote bags, all of the the world of Momofuku is yours.
Right. So do your new desserts make it onto the list?
The ones that will ship safely make it onto the website. And there's plenty of other ones too. We have chocolate chip passion fruit cake truffles and pineapple upside down cake truffles with coconut. There's plenty to choose from.
So I promised you I wouldn't ask what the future holds, because you never know.
No.
You're a real risk taker.
If you asked me 4 years ago, I'd be like, I have no clue. Maybe I'll move to Richmond, Virginia and have a little clothing store. You know, I would have no clue that I would be here in 4 years. But I think that, you know, our big thing is to really stay true to ourselves and keep pushing, to be mindful of what the world is dealing with in terms of sustainability and health concerns and stuff like that. And to just stay as creative and true to ourselves and to what we promise to the industry every day. I'm excited to see what that means tomorrow and the next day.
Well,
I promise it'll be something good.
I can't imagine ending the show with any better comments. Thank you so much for being here. It was truly a delight to talk to you. And I can't wait to start eating more.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Thanks for all the cookies. Bye. And I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Jack Inslee, our producer, Heidi Tickle, and Joe Sevier, my assistant producers. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.